Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
So welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Endgame. Joining us for a repeat appearance is our friend Michael Cow, the urban cowboy. And on a day when the Fed are meeting and have surprised a few and confirmed a few, as they always do, what better chance to have a conversation? So joining me, as always, is my partner, Bill Fleckenstein. Bill, how are you, mate?
I'm doing fine. And in the case of Michael, I think we need to say a repeat offender.
A repeat offender, yeah. Well, you know what? Let's leave that judgment to others, shall we? Michael, welcome back to The Endgame, my friend. How are you?
I'll take that as a compliment.
we are literally, I think, is the press conference on now? Or is it is on now, right? So you guys can probably see it. I can't. I'm in the wilds of Tasmania, so I can't see anything but snakes and kangaroos down here, which is probably a similar view to the audience at the press conference. But I'll leave it to you guys to tell me if anything crazy happens. But, you know, an epic week. A crazy week. Michael, let's start off with just your thoughts on the week. There's a whole bunch of stuff we can get into, but has anything changed materially this week, either for what the Fed has to do in its battle for inflation or the mindset of market participants?
It's been a crazy week and a half, but I'll start by saying that, you know, from my base case, I don't think anything has changed. I've been saying for a while now that I think the Fed's big picture mandate here is to get inflation down. And unfortunately, it's got one tool to do it. Monetary policy as a sledgehammer to get aggregate demand down. How do you get aggregate demand down? Well, you have to slow the economy down, lower incomes, and raise unemployment. And so when you go back to, I guess, two Sundays ago when the Silicon Valley Bank news was just breaking, I tweeted out, my prediction of what would happen, which is that they would use surgical actions to ring fence what seemed to me like a largely idiosyncratic affair, nothing like the global financial crisis, and that it would preclude a huge policy shift from the overall inflation fight. And so I've been using this moniker that BTFP does not equal BTFD. For the two reasons of, one, that means that they're going to continue keeping conditions tight for longer than certainly what many asset classes are pricing, including the omniscient yield curve, which actually seems to be not much of a not a better crystal ball than any other asset class. And then the other reason why BTFP does not equal BTFD is that, you know, I think we all remember that a guarantee or a bailout of depositors certainly does not equal a bailout for investors. And so I warned also that, look, shotgun marriages in banks and forced liquidity injections usually exact their pound of flesh. And we've definitely seen that with all of the regionals here and then as well as CS.
Yeah, it has been an epic week, and this idea that the Fed are stuck on course, you know, it's been amazing to me just how much virtual ink has been spilled this week talking about again the pivot, you know, and it's almost as if every single sign is a reason for the people who believe that the pivot is inevitable, which look, I'm sure at some point it is inevitable. You posted a phenomenal moving graphic last week of the, I think it was last week or maybe a few days ago, of the
last night, actually.
Last night, okay. I mean, just talk through that, because for people who haven't seen it, they should dig out the tweet on your timeline, because the story that graphic tells is an extraordinary one.
Yeah, I literally just talked about this on this space earlier. So it basically shows expectations of the Fed funds rate and how it's been just whipping around like mad. And my sort of caption around that tweet was that Now, when you consider that the risk-free rate is the linchpin for all things financial, right? Whether it's, you know, stocks, bonds, you know, everything that can be valued with a discounted cash flow, this volatility in rate expectations of something so fundamental is kind of akin to oscillating the bottommost Jenga block of a shaky tower. And so because of that, be careful not to conflate, you know, the big moves and any sort of risk assets as that meaningful and signal content, because what you're really witnessing is just the tip of the whip here. You know, if the handle of the whip is oscillating like crazy, can you imagine trying to read too much meaning in the tip of the whip?
You know, this brings up a point, one of the things you said a second ago, Michael, that sort of drives me crazy. And that is this. Every column that gets written about what the bond market does always talks about the bond market pricing and something the Fed's going to do. You know, that's a mathematical construct. It might be reality, but it doesn't have to be reality, because bond investors across the curve do one thing or another based on the economy or the dollar or the fiscal policy or monetary policy or whatever, and they move rates to a certain point. It's not an implicit future Fed response, but everything is always written that way.
100%.
But why do you think so few people have the conversation like what I just said and what you agree with? Why does it always get written in the manner, well, this, it's all about Fed expectations, when that's really not the case?
It's weird, because there's almost like a market consensus that the bond market is infallible and kind of smells things before any other asset class. But to me, I've also tweeted quite a bit about this, saying that, you know, the bond market is another voting mechanism like any other market, and it's subject to the same sets of recency biases as every other market. And the biggest recency bias that is worth discussing is that, you know, we've literally had decades of endless liquidity lotteries, you know, what I call it. And the bond market is no different than the equity market in terms of being desensitized to that liquidity lottery. And one of the biggest cornerstones behind my theory that the Fed is going to keep conditions higher for longer here is when you look at a long-term chart of the core PCE, and since the early 90s, you see that essentially throughout the decades, right, it stayed very well behaved between, like, say, you know, 1.5% and 2.5% until recently. It's, you know, spiked above 5%, right? It's a clear outlier, this recent spike. And so then you think about, okay, every crisis since 1994, you take 94, 98, 2000, GFC, they've all been easily papered over by monetary policy because, for various reasons, inflation has stayed well behaved, not this time. And my view on that, I think we talked about it maybe in our last chat, was some of the sources of that. My own view is that it kind of stemmed from the commodity sector. But Pandora's box got left open for way too long, and it's now leapt into much stickier components. And when you think about companies raising prices now, in some regards, it depends on their pricing power, right? But certainly you're seeing wholesale raising of prices because the zeitgeist, the expectation is that it's okay to raise prices now. And so that's what the Fed is desperately trying to tamp down. And so far, at least, it really hasn't had that much success. And then the other thing I would add, though, is that, see, again, going back to the BTFP does not equal BTFD concept, I don't think anything is broken here, especially given how they've been able to ring fence it. Just a week ago, with the fallout from the Silicon Valley Bank thing, I got invited to a couple of private chat groups where, you know, the messages were like flying furiously every couple of seconds about, you know, when are people expecting their checks and how this is going to destroy the innovation economy and blah, 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 blah. I just tried to like rejoin the chat just to see what's up. Chat's gone. There's no more. It's forgotten. It's totally forgotten. Okay. So what's broken here? The S&P is up like 14% from the lows. The QQQ is up like 23% from the lows. What exactly is broken? And so then you go back to the big picture here and why inflation is so important. Inflation is the most regressive tax of all. It affects 100% of people. And when people bellyache about, you know, this is going to destroy jobs, et cetera, I keep saying, look, I don't want to sound callous about this at all, but what do you think the Fed has been trying to do for the last 15 months? The Fed has actually said that they would be okay with unemployment potentially going up to 4.6% from the current 3.6%. That is not a job loss of 20,000 or 200,000. That's a job loss of 1.5 million to 2 million jobs. Nothing has broken. So the trade-off between the dual mandates of like price stability and inflation fight is simply not here. And when you consider the fact that other economic zones, namely the UK and the Eurozone, right? When you consider that their GDPs are already at the zero bound, and you know, with Eurozone unemployment running at a six handle relative to our three handle here in the US, and yet Christine Lagarde just went ahead with 50 bips, you know, granted they're behind the eight ball, right? And then the UK, if you remember after, with the gilt crisis, again, they used a surgical approach, but it did not derail their overall inflation fight. So I really think that that will be the same here. And I don't necessarily, I mean, you know, this is not an out of consensus view anymore, but I don't think the rug pull for risk assets from here is necessarily a much higher terminal Fed funds rate. But I think risk assets are mispriced for how long potentially we're going to stay at restrictive conditions.
I'd like to maybe, I don't want to say push back, but I don't think it's fair to say that nothing is broken. I think that these banks that have been hammered, it's certainly the fallout that it looked like we were going to get, that the letter of the law would have allowed to have happen, did not occur for sure. But I think there's a lag in this. And I think the disintermediation process that is now being advertised 24/7 with all the news is a big deal. And I think there will be consequences like dominoes that will tip over into each other as we get price discovery of other mismarked products, be it corporate bonds or venture marks or other marks like that. So I think things have started to break, but we just haven't had one that like has made the stock market faint, basically. But I think it could still be in front of us.
That I agree with. But I do want to say, though, that I think maybe because banking is the ultimate example of fragility in terms of potential asset liability mismatches, just because of the short duration nature of the liability side of the balance sheet. And then, of course, given the most recent memory of the GFC, banking is what everybody frets on. But that's precisely why I don't think the epicenter of the next crisis is going to be in banking. I actually think the epicenter probably is going to be in shadow banking sector. And, you know, that's a very loosely defined term. But, you know, as an ex hedge funder like yourself, Bill, I've been on the other side of asset liability mismatch in the hedge fund side. You know, in 2006, you may remember there was an ARB fund called Amaranth that blew up because of natural gas bets, right? Well, yeah. I had a very chunky LP. It was a $5 billion fund of funds that was invested in Amaranth. And they were also invested in me. Unbeknownst to me, they were promising their LPs 30-day liquidity when they were invested in managers like me that had quarterly and annual liquidity. Mm-hmm. So in 2007, they had their version of a run on the bank, and they put their entire fund of funds in liquidation and had to, you know, redeem out of managers like me that had nothing to do with that whole fiasco. And then, you know, imagine. So I've been on the other side of that type of harrowing experience, which also happened to careen into the events of 2008. So it was a very harrowing time. But okay, so where else could there be icebergs? I think when you look at, again, going back to Silicon Valley Bank, yes, they've protected depositors, but you can surely bet that this is going to put a chill on lending to that specific sector, right? And so what's going to happen to all the VC firms where their underlying portfolio companies are now starved of capital? By the way, the whole notion of venture debt, what the fuck is that? Like, to me, as a former credit investor, the biggest sin you can commit is to take equity risk for a fixed income return. So what the fuck is venture debt? Why is that even a thing? Why was that ever a thing? But my point, though, is that these VC funds are going to be issuing capital calls. And who are their LPs? Well, their LPs are going to be, it could be high net worth people. It could be endowments, teacher retirement funds. They're going to be having to write checks when other parts of their portfolio might be blowing up. So to me, the question is, this setup reminds me much more like a potential 1998 situation than a 2008. The question is whether or not those underlying icebergs are going to be deemed too big to fail, like LTCM, to precipitate a bazooka or, you know, like a major shift in policy stance. And so far, I don't think that's the case.
Right. But these things do take time to spill over onto each other. As you pointed out, what happened to you and all that. So all I'm saying is a fuse may have been lit, even though the bomb hasn't been detonated yet.
Yeah. As Julian Brigden said to me, it's like when someone throws a grenade on the table and it doesn't go off and goes, phew, it's a dud, right? And then a few minutes later, the whole thing explodes. But let's talk about the Silicon Valley, Michael. You brought that up. And I'm curious to know what you thought about the solution they came up with to that particular problem. Because on the Friday night or the Saturday night, whenever it was over the weekend that they released their statement and quietly shut Signature Bank, you know, almost as a theatrical aside, it seemed like a pragmatic approach to the problem. And they learned from 08 and wiping out the shareholders immediately and making that very clear that that was going to happen. So that was obviously throwing a bone to the people who said in 08, you didn't wipe out shareholders. But then, I don't know if you saw Yellen's testimony and the questioning by James Lankford, the Oklahoma representative. Did you see that, you guys? You didn't see that? Okay, so Yellen was being...
I definitely did. Yellen right. basically yelled fire in a crowded right. bank.
Yeah, this guy represents the hardworking people of Oklahoma. And he said to her, look, you know, does you backstopping depositors mean that all my farms in Oklahoma, their deposits are backstopped? And Yellen, it wasn't just what she said, but it was the way she said it. She said, look, it doesn't mean that. It's because Silicon Valley Bank was systemic. And he said, well, why are my banks not systemic? And she said, well, we'll decide who's systemic or not. And he pushed back on this and he pushed back on this. And he was absolutely right to do that. And the way Yellen handled it and how floundered she was, A, suggests to me that they hadn't potentially thought this through, which I find almost impossible to believe. But it felt in the moment, given the fact that these small mid-sized banks are a significant part of the lending in the US. I mean, literally half of all loans are pretty much run through these banks, that they just backstopped $8 trillion of deposits. Because how do you possibly come out and say, no, I'm sorry, your bank is not systemic? They just can't do that now.
I have a take on exactly this issue. So look, I think we all agree at this point, Silicon Valley Bank is an example of gross mismanagement of risk, both on the asset side of the balance sheet and on the liability side of the balance sheet, especially on the liability side of the balance sheet. Because, you know, when you've got a bank that's where 97% of deposits are uninsured, coming from essentially one very focused sector of the economy, right? That's a lack of diversification. Now, that's okay, I guess, if you have extremely, extremely tightly managed asset side of the balance sheet. But I would argue even it's still very, very wobbly when the liability side is so concentrated like that. But so my view is that if you are a depositor to any bank, you are really definitionally an unsecured creditor. And you should at least be doing a modicum of due diligence on the bank that you're, you know, putting hundreds of millions of dollars of treasury cash to, right? That obviously didn't happen. And yet all these guys got 100 cents on the dollar. I don't agree with that. However, I will say though, that when you're looking through the lens of fighting the last war and looking at GFC, and we all know that the frailty of the fractional reserve banking system is that when stuff like this happens, it can metastasize and careen into even more responsibly managed banks when there's just full-blown panic. One of the biggest lessons I think the authorities learned, at least from reading the tea leaves from the great financial crisis, is how damaging inconsistent policy was. So if you remember, a week before Lehman failed, what happened? They literally seized Fannie and Freddie totally by surprise. They had arbitrary treatment between different layers of the capital stack, which doesn't engender confidence. They forced a shotgun wedding for Countrywide, but then seized WAMU when there was barely any run on WAMU, which had much stickier deposits. And then in the next breath, they wind up saving Wachovia. So that was truly a situation where I think the policymakers were running around like chickens with their heads cut off. And, you know, so that was a very, very scary time. And I think that really, really shattered confidence in the capital markets. So this time, as repugnant as it is to have like a full sort of depositor bailout, I think they had to do it. But yet, I will echo a sentiment put out by Joseph Wang, Fed guy, who has said repeatedly that, you know, some of these tools are elements of being able to provide liquidity, but at a restrictive price. And you notice that the BTFP facility actually had very low total uptake, right? And even the discount window, right? That is still liquidity at a restrictive price. It's not the same as QE. It's not the same as providing liquidity with a multiplier effect. It's actually, you can almost call it contractionary liquidity in a way. So I think a lot of risk assets are taking the wrong message from this. That's my opinion.
I want to take a step back on something that you said. You went back to 08, you talked about the inconsistency. I saw the same thing. I was actively involved with my short fund, but I would make the point that some of the quote unquote inconsistency was because until we got really deep into 08 and Paulson and everybody got involved, they didn't really have any idea what was going on. Remember, after Greenspan championed repealing Glass-Steagall, as part of the deal to let commercial banks and brokerage firms merge, the Fed was supposed to specifically regulate those entities. They did not do their job. And not only that, they let them get away with the special purpose investment vehicles so they could take all that toxic garbage and hold it off balance sheet and lever themselves up to the moon. So they had done all of these things that many of us saw. And yet when it started to go bad, they didn't understand it, and they're going at it ad hoc. And I think that's the same thing now, only worse. They haven't thought through any of this. Where was the Fed in regulating these entities, particularly SIVB? The thing blows up in their face. And instead of letting the people who didn't do their due diligence have to suffer and get 85 or 90 cents and go through some inconvenience and to finally set a message, they just bail them all out. So I think there's such gross incompetence across the regulatory apparatus and the people who are supposed to be in charge, that I don't know that we can draw much from what they do or say, because I don't think they know anything. Lastly, remember, Bernanke said subprime was contained before the shit had even started to hit the fan. Pardon my technical term there. Anyway, so sorry. I mean, you probably don't disagree with much of that, but perhaps the way I phrased it. I think that's one of the things that's so galling, is people still seem to think that the people that are in charge know what they're doing and they don't have a clue.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with that. Although I will say, though, that I think what I really don't like are the takes out there that this is all the fault of the Fed and somehow the culpability doesn't lie here with the banks, because you know, here, this was really a situation of gross mismanagement on yes. both sides of the balance sheet, right?
Yes.
And so,
yes.
like, you know,
yes.
so you can't say, I think the biggest sin of the Fed isn't what it's doing right now. It's the endless decades of liquidity lottery.
Yep. Yep.
Right. And so yep. I think of it as like, you know, the big, you know, fuck up by the Fed was that this is the antidote to the fuck up. And it's going to be a painful one, I think.
Yeah. The problem is, what we don't know is how these problems roll together. And my belief, based on having watched these guys in action and watched this, you know, debacle build, is that events will overtake the Fed, and whatever they think their game plan is, it's going to be different, because I think there's more shoes to drop, you know, particularly as you just mentioned, like what you talked about, what happened with Amaranth And in that time period, a lot of us had experiences with people that were supposed to be not have liquidity, demanded liquidity. Well, a lot of these entities like that are the big capital providers, where they want to talk about state pension plans or other places like that, they've got bad marks on their private illiquid side, which they beefed up. And now they're going to have problems on the liquid side. So I just think there's a whole lot beneath the iceberg that we can see that we don't really know how it's going to play out. I mean, I didn't have Silicon Valley on my bingo card as the first one to go under in this mess. I wish I'd thought of that, but.
Yeah, same. I mean, yeah, what's going to be the forcing function? That's the question I keep asking, right? With banks, the forcing function obviously is the typical bank run. Here's another take that I have a problem with. There's a take that, oh, well, if you look at like the entire held to maturity losses, then the entire banking sector is insolvent. But what's the forcing function? Is everybody going to take their money out of every bank? I mean, that's not going to happen. That's just not going to happen. So,
but Michael, surely it is a problem if they start taking money out of smaller banks and shoving it into JP Morgan and Bank of America. You know, that's where potentially the problem lies. And I think that's why they had to jump on this quickly, because that creates material
problems. Now, unfortunately, I think that trend is bound to happen. Unfortunately, yeah. I think the gone are the days of the Jimmy Stewart, you know, little home savings and loans.
Well, we all saw a version of this in the 80s when there was disintermediation of the money funds. And, you know, there's that, you know, I think a lot of people were kind of slow to move, and now they can see they can get more in money funds. I mean, that exodus is going to continue. So it's not just going to be small bank to big bank. It's going to be out of banks into money funds, in my opinion. So that'll create more pressure.
And treasuries.
And treasuries, yeah. Unless the banks ramp their deposit rates and crash their margins.
And then they slowly bleed to death. Right. I mean, there's, when you think about the trap that these banks are in, they got no good choices, a lot of them. And none of that is constructive for capital markets. It's only constructive for accidents.
By the way, this is why, I don't know if you guys remember, but last summer I wrote a kind of a controversial thread. It was called The Case for a Bear Steepener.
Yeah, I remember that.
And in it, I basically said, look, the problem with using just the Fed funds rate as a blunt tool and taking it sky high is exactly what we're facing right now, right? Where you're going to have an inverted yield curve. You're going to crush net interest margins at a time when a lot of loans are going to be going bad at the same time. But I basically said, look, if somehow the Fed and Treasury were to get together and try to engineer a bear steepener, you force long rates to go higher to depress long-lived asset prices, like real estate being a large component of inflation. And maybe that obviates the need for taking Fed funds to even the current level. Maybe they could have kept Fed funds capped at 4%, let's say, and you keep NIMs positive, et cetera. But you know, obviously that did not turn out to be what's happened, but, you know, I just wonder. But then you could also argue that maybe that breaks other things too.
Can I bring up a topic out of left field, one that we've never talked about on this Endgame podcast that relates to the Endgame, but I think might be germane to how things play out going forward in a different way? Am I allowed to do that, Grant?
Hell, why not? It's our podcast, but we can do whatever the hell we want.
Okay, so I'm going to bring up the debt ceiling. Now, I've always yawned when people say the debt ceiling is going to be, you know, cause this, that kind of problem, because they always just kick the can. However, it seems like the fight this time might be far more contentious for obvious political reasons. And it's kind of at a moment in time when there's plenty of other problems that have not exactly instilled confidence, perhaps in the administration that's running the show right now. And it seems to me we could get into a particular spot where people start looking at the, you know, no one's focused on the size of the deficit or the unsustainability in the wake of not only not having QE, but adding QT to the process. And now you got banks that can't really take down paper. So it seems to me like you've got a shortage of buyers. Foreign central banks aren't buying, you know, our paper that much anymore. At a moment in time, while we're going to have a battle we've been through a million times that hasn't mattered, might that be a catalyst for re-examining some of these things? And maybe then even they look at the Fed balance sheet and realize that it's upside down. Is there any chance that that could be some kind of a spark, do you think?
I'll say, though, I tend to come out on the side of relative strength, right? So in February, you know, I co-wrote and presented this paper at West Point, and it was basically talking about the role of the US dollar in all of this, and how this whole notion that, you know, we are so screwed because of our high debt to GDP and blah, 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 blah. There's going to be all these rushes to alternatives. But the first third of the paper, I would say, is to kind of push back on that theory and say that, look, if you go back to examining history and you look at, you know, what happened at Bretton Woods, there's this general notion that trust in the US dollar was all because of this gold convertibility. And then there was this big rug pull with the Nixon shock of 1971. But then how do you explain that there was this very big rise in Eurodollar banking in the 50s, in the mid 50s, before the abandonment of gold convertibility? And so our paper explores this notion of, look, the trust in a country's fiat stems ultimately from national power. And we focused on three pillars of national power: geography, the natural resources, industrial capacity. But my point is that as profligate as the US has been, it's actually not even close to being the worst sinner when you compare it to all of the other major central banks of the world, whether you're comparing it to, you know, the BOE, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the PBOC. So I think that the US dollar denominated system is far stronger comparatively than most other fiats for a lot of these reasons. And, you know, so for all the voices that said because of our debt to GDP and the high interest costs of raising the rate and pushing us into these giant deficits, well, that's all true. You can't argue with that math. But my point is that because of these relative strengths that U.S. Economy currently boasts, as well as there's two different things, right? There's current relative macroeconomic strength that determines a currency's exchange rate. But then there's the much deeper sort of endogenous factors of what determines trust in a country's fiat for why the US dollar has retained its global reserve currency status. And the US is strong on a relative basis on both fronts, vis-a-vis all other fiats. So I think that the can and will be pushed for far longer than people think, at least enough for this inflation fight to be dealt with, I think.
I'm sympathetic to that argument that, I mean, the dollar has no real competition when you compare it to the central bank policies of other G7 countries. So I didn't mean to imply that I was in that camp. What I will say is what could be a problem is when you don't look at it on a relative to GDP basis and just look at it on the pure volume. I mean, our debt doesn't look that bad relative to GDP compared to other countries. But when you look at the sheer volume of the size of it, it's a big, big number. So
it seems like treasuries always rip in every flight to quality. When there's a scare, right? So that's what's kind of interesting, because again, it's a relative comparison.
That's more of a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, sometimes we see the yen rally and supposed flight to quality because the people that are doing that a lot of times are just doing it.
But is it though? There was this very interesting paper that we cited in our paper that talked about how, you know, this notion that, the biggest critique against the dollar system is that, you know, we are profligate spenders and Asia, they're savers, and we're in this, you know, constant deficit system, right? But the other view, which is the one that I actually espouse, is that I think by virtue of being the global reserve currency, that part is a feature and not a bug. You are definitionally, you know, funding the surplus of other countries. You're acting as that sort of global shock absorber. And one thing this other paper that we cited pointed out that I thought was very interesting is that the depth of our US Treasury market relative to other sovereign bond markets, I think the quote was something like, in many cases, the demand from, I guess, the savers out of Asia is sometimes 10 times as high as the underlying liquidity of their own internal sovereign bond liquidity. So there's only one place for all that surplus to go, and that's the U.S. Treasury market.
Michael, let me ask you, because a big part of this is, as you said at the very beginning, of that trust, and trust in the U.S. dollar and trust in the U.S. government for whatever reasons you want to place trust in them. But I can't help but think that the move by the Treasury to freeze Russian assets at the beginning of the Ukraine war has necessarily changed that. I mean, I think if you are a central banker who holds a significant amount of dollar reserves and you continue to trust completely the way you used to trust before that day in the Federal Reserve, I think that's a foolish thing to do. I'm not saying you're wrong to do it, but you're certainly wrong to not think about the strength of that trust going forward. We've seen definitely things happening in the gold market vis-a-vis central banks that suggest there is at least at the fringes, an effort to try and diversify away from dollars. There must be a tipping point out there somewhere that all these moves that people say are inconsequential and bilateral deals being done in oil to trade in various currencies are all at the margin insignificant. And relatively speaking, they are at the moment. But it seems to me that there is a very deliberate move to at least assess options to the US dollar. And I feel like once that process starts, that's a ball that doesn't stop, because it kind of can't stop. How do you replace that trust? Do you think any of this matters right now, or matters down the track, or it's just smoke and mirrors timing?
So we actually addressed this in our paper. And by the way, I 100% agree with you. When people talk about weaponization of the dollar, most typically they're referring to these financial sanctions that encompassed, you know, the seizure of Russia's FX reserves. So for the record, our paper actually advocates exactly against that. In our paper, what we're saying is that, look, the U.S. dollar-led rules-based order, if you will, right, is akin to, and I'm going to borrow a framework that Mike Green and I riffed about. Think of it as we have the best sports facility, right? And we should be doing all we can to make sure that that sports facility is state-of-the-art and has the best rule of law and everything, right? And let's encourage everybody to come play in our sports court. And that's what our paper says. But our paper also says that, look, there are other ways, instead of overt financial sanctions that actively drive this search for alternatives, there are two things that we should focus on. One is industrial policies that actually are aligned with our geostrategic interests. And we draw these comparisons between, for instance, the semiconductor industry and the oil and gas industry. And the semiconductor industry, even though the U.S. commands critical choke points in that supply chain, like in semiconductor design software, in semiconductor equipment manufacturers, right? And we're still much better relatively positioned than China. But even so, we are now coming belatedly to the aid of that industry with the CHIPS Act and doing targeted exports, export controls, et cetera, to China, right? So that's an example where we're actually finally doing some of the right things from an industrial standpoint, industrial policy standpoint. But when you compare and contrast that to our energy policy, it is almost the opposite. Our energy policy is an example of us basically shooting ourselves in our own foot, because look, the U.S. is currently the largest producer in the world. I don't think that's going to persist, because I don't think the ingredients that went into the shale revolution are going to coalesce together anytime soon. But be that as it may, right now, the U.S. produces 12.5 million barrels per day relative to Saudi Arabia and Russia, each producing about 11 million barrels per day. That said, our dependency on OPEC is a 40% dependency, right? But our policies are literally trying to downgrade or that dependency from a 40% on OPEC to an 85% dependency on rare earths from China and the Congo, right? So yeah. Like in what parallel universe does that make good risk reward sense? We're doing all the wrong things. We've gutted our SPR long before there's a geopolitical crisis. The SPR was established in response to the 1973 Arab oil embargo. We haven't seen a real geopolitical premium in oil. So our paper talks about how, look, we need to first make our sports court as good as it can be, to continue encouraging people to play in our court. But then the second, the very last part of our paper is just where we talk about the current macroeconomic cycle and pointing out how the U.S. right now, because we've got a domestic inflation fight that we are waging, we literally could just continue that fighting that inflation fight and thereby essentially creating a strong dollar policy, and or I should really reframe it as not create the conditions for an overt weak dollar policy, which is what we've been doing for the last couple of decades, especially after COVID, right? That was an overt weak dollar policy. And what we're saying is that if you have a strong dollar policy and you consider the precarious nature of China's balance sheet and how their sovereign balance sheet, as quote, clean as it looks from a debt to GDP perspective, is a complete facade. When you actually look beneath the covers and you look at, you know, where their debt's actually hidden, it's hidden, between the SOEs, the LGFVs, the property developers. So China's actually the most indebted country in the world. There was a very, very interesting podcast that I cited in this recent piece that I wrote entitled Ball in a China Shop. Are you familiar with this guy, Andrew Hunt?
No.
So I guess he's, I think his background is like, you know, UK banking analyst or something like that. But anyways, he's been focused on China, and it was very, very eyebrow raising, where he's done some forensic analysis using, you know, Chinese language translators, going through like 36 of the largest Chinese banks. And he's basically saying that there's a $4 trillion gap between what is publicly reported in the balance of payments data, China, and what is actually on their balance sheet. And so he thinks that Chinese banks have effectively borrowed $4 trillion more than is publicly reported in U.S. dollar denominated debt. So not only is there a duration mismatch, there is a currency mismatch, and the underlying collateral is problematic as well. So anyways, long exposition of what we were talking about in the paper, but that's kind of how I view the U.S. system, I guess, comparing to other fiat systems.
Michael, just going on to that, I'm glad you brought that China piece up. It was a fantastic thread. Just talk a little bit about the extrapolations of that and the scenario you just outlined, the possible transmission mechanism as to how that becomes a problem.
Well, I think China, look, every worldwide central bank is facing a Scylla Charybdis issue. And I love mythological references, right? So, you know, that mythological reference refers to Odysseus's harrowing journey between the Scylla monster and the Charybdis whirlpool, right? And so, you know, ours is obviously, look, if you keep monetary conditions tight, then maybe you're going to break something. But if you don't, then we've got this inflation issue. Well, China's, I think, is that writ large, because, you know, we have the benefit of having global reserve currency status, which also means that global commodities are priced in US dollars. China does not. China imports 80 to 90% of its oil, which is denominated in US dollars. And so their Scylla Charybdis problem is that on the one hand, the Scylla of a weaker Chinese yuan is that they potentially import commodity price inflation. They also have a potential problem with what we just talked about, this duration and currency mismatch with their banking system, right? But on the other hand, their economy, I call it flogging the dead horse, right? Both Japan and China have the same problem, but China's is a big deal. In January, there was much ado about this great Chinese reopening, and their PMIs were very, very strong. But as one of my favorite macro analysts, Lakshmi at Capital One, points out, PMI index is a measure of breadth and not depth. And when you consider the magnitude of the stimulus, it was after a 6 trillion yuan stimulus. And yet the biggest tell on the lack of a Chinese reopening is what's happened to oil prices, right? So
yeah.
So China being an export driven economy needs a weaker yuan. So the Charybdis side of their problem is that if they keep the yuan strong, relatively strong, they're going to have a really hard time defibrillating their economy. And mind you, the point of that Substack post, Grant, was to point out that I think that this Silicon Valley Bank issue could really be kind of a provincial sideshow relative to the biggest elephant in the room, which is if China blows up, that will send a massive deflationary pulse. And I just see that, you know, a risk of a yuan devaluation is getting higher and higher. The difficulty is that this has been kind of a widowmaker of a trade, right? Everybody's been crying this thing for a long time now. And it's very, very hard when you have such an opaque banking system that's becoming even more opaque. It's hard to judge when that Minsky moment arrives. But I think we probably, all three of us, agree here. It's closer now than it was 10 years ago, for sure.
And also, I think when we have unravelings here in the financial system, and you've got Europe's banking system is a mess, the UK's got its own special problems, these things can help bring down something like that that might be ready to go. I'm not saying
that's it. So another example of like a surgical fix is the use of FX swap lines, right? But guess what? The FX swap lines are only for friends of the US. The PBOC does not have access to that. So I was reading this paper from like the GFC era. It was very interesting. I was just doing a little bit of research on FX swap lines. And when you look at what the dollar basis did relative to, this is a little bit wonky, but when you compare, like everybody looks at the, you know, LIBOR OIS spread, you know, and how it blew out. And then the use of introduction of FX swap lines kind of mitigated that. But what's less known is that the US dollar basis, I guess, is a similar measure of this type of interbanking stress, except encompassing a much broader swath of banks and not just like the LIBOR consortium banks, right? It blew out much, much wider than the LIBOR OAS basis. And so that gives you an indication about how in times of stress like this, the non-dollar based foreign central banks usually wind up having a shortage of dollars. And this currency swap is basically allowing them to not have to essentially sell assets, right? Without much net currency effect. It's another example of providing liquidity, but at a price to the Fed, right? They have to pay interest to the Fed. China doesn't have that protection. And, you know, it maybe 10 years ago, the state of U.S.-China relations was such that if the PBOC ran into a problem, maybe the Fed bails them out. And in today's day and age, I'm not so sure that happens.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Guys, listen, I'm mindful of the time, and there are a bunch of other things I'd love to talk about, risking opening another topic up now when there's only 3 minutes left. We've all got hard out. It's just a dangerous one. So Michael, hopefully we can get you to come back again, because there is so much more to talk about. And, you know, I suspect that things are going to get more interesting before they get less so for a while. So we'll keep an eye on that. In the meantime, look, Michael, just let people know more about Musings and the other places they can read your stuff, because your threads on Twitter particularly are absolutely epic, and the Substack's coming on. So just let people know how they can kind of follow you all.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I'm at Urban Cowboy on Twitter, where I usually just put my stream of consciousness stuff. And ever since, I still don't know why I got suspended in January, but I started putting I started migrating a bunch of my content on Substack. So I think what I'm doing is it's urbancowboy.substack.com. I'm putting more my longer form stuff on that Substack, as well as I've started doing like a weekly recap on there.
Fantastic. Well, listen, my friend, I wish you the best with it. And hopefully you'll come back and talk to us again. Bill, thanks to
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
My man.
Thank you, guys.
The heat down in the desert. I am actually going to go out and play golf in Tasmania, where I'm told there are hundreds of tiger snakes and they're nasty things. So I'm slightly terrified.
Well, good luck, mate.
Yeah, I'll see if I can avoid it. Thanks again, fellas. Enjoy
Thank
the rest
you
of your
guys.
Day, and we'll talk again soon.
Take care.
Great.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care.
Well, my apologies for the truncated end to that podcast. All three of us had deadlines to get out. Mine was the most enjoyable deadline because I'm off to play golf, as I said, risking getting bitten by a snake. So if this is the last ever Grant Williams podcast, you know exactly why I got snake bit. My thanks to Fleck, as always. He didn't get a chance to tell you, but you should follow him on Twitter. If you don't, you'll find him at FleckCap. He's still there, I hope. I can't see any reason why I wouldn't be. For Michael, Urban Cowboy, Cowboy is spelled K-A-O-B-O-Y, both in his Twitter feed and urbancowboy.substack.com. And again, if you haven't followed Michael's stuff, it's some of the most thoughtful content you'll find out there. So I would strongly encourage that you do that. In the meantime, I'll be back again with another podcast in the very near future. Thank you very much for listening.
Nothing we discussed during the endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.